My name's Jane Bowman. I am the Vice President of Marketing and Strategic Partnerships for the Boston Globe. So they give me this time to do a quick little commercial, so please listen to my commercial. Please subscribe to the Globe, and I'll tell you why. If you've read the Globe for a while, thank you. If you haven't seen us in a while, we have so many new, fresh, smart, strong voices. Janae Osterhelt is our new culture writer. We've got Deborah First and Erin Kushner, who's new, just in from Austin, food writers. Janelle Ninos, our business writer. Shirley Leung, one of our great columnists. We've got Noura Princiati. We've got Tara Sullivan, both on sports writer, sports columnist. There are so many strong, smart voices. Thank you for subscribing. Those of you who aren't subscribing yet, there's a code in the book, in our ad, and you get 2 weeks free. So give us a two-week try, and then keep coming back. So that's my commercial. The other thing I want to say is one thing about this conference that I love is that there are so many people that take time out of their day and actually give themselves a whole full day to spend on themselves. It's miraculous, and it's smart, and I'm glad that you're here. I want to introduce Virgie Tovar, who I met in the hallway, and I had never met her before, but when I saw her coming, I just felt this energy. And I'm like, this must be her! And it was. And as I've been sitting around for a couple minutes, I've heard people who heard you speak last night. I heard smart, interesting, energetic, all the things and all the reasons why we want to be here. So you know who she is because that's why you're here, but she's one of the nation's leading experts and lecturers on weight-based discrimination and diet culture. She's got a master's in sexuality studies. She's written books. She's an advocate. She's everything that you want to be, and a friend, and a mentor, and like I'm just so excited to be here on stage with you. So I'm going to leave you hear from her, but what I want to say is after this session, she will be selling her book. Go buy it, and I will say that again at the end. She wrote a book. She's got another one coming out. Go buy it. That's my commercial. So thank you.
And thank you. Thank you for having me. Forgive me. I'm just going to grab a quick my notes. So in 2014, I started an online course in hopes of democratizing ideas that had radically altered the trajectory of my life. Primary among them were the ideas that I, a fat woman, one, had the right to stop dieting forever. Two, that food restriction is not a health-promoting or wellness-promoting behavior. Three, that the negative messages I grew up receiving about my body were not only incorrect, but immoral. Four, that this issue is about human rights. It is not about health or health promotion. And five, that I had the right to demand respect, set boundaries, heal from body shame, wear whatever I wanted, live without apologies, and thrive. Thank you. I decided to call it Babe Camp because I wanted to teach others how to be a babe at any size. I invite you into my world for the next hour. Let's begin with a teensy meditation. I'm from California. I invite you to close your eyes and get comfortable. Relax your shoulders. Relax your belly. If you're clenching your thighs to keep them close together, you can just let them go. If you're clenching your butt, you can unclench that as well. You can wiggle your toes to relax your feet. And wiggle your fingers to relax your hands. We're going to breathe in and fill up our belly as much as we can. Keep breathing in and out. Just keep breathing. It's okay if your mind wanders. You can bring yourself back into your body by touching your index fingers together with your thumb or touching the chair. Keep breathing on your own time and just listen to my voice. I want to bring your focus to your body. It is a precious entity that takes us through life. The elements in our bodies are the same elements that make up the magical and vast universe. The same material that makes up the stars and the planet, the deserts, the oceans, the most wonderful and strange animals, the rainforest. These same elements make up your body. Our bodies connect us to everything and everyone in the universe. Right now, we're going to take a few seconds to bask in gratitude and awe over what our bodies are doing right now. Feel your heart beating without conscious effort. Feel your lungs filling up and allowing you to breathe. Every single day, our bodies process light, sound, and sensation without effort. Every day, our bodies metabolize food and turn it into fuel. Without conscious effort, our skin feels light and the touch of our loved ones. Our ears discern who we're talking to and how they're feeling. Our eyes process the colors all around us, the green and brown of changing leaves, the blue of the ocean, all without effort. Your body is incredible. There is nothing wrong with your body. No matter what kind of pain you have, no matter what your body looks like, no matter if you have a chronic condition, an illness, or a disability, there is nothing wrong with your body. Imagine a world where you feel no shame about your body. You eat what you want without worry. You move for the sake of fun and pleasure. You prioritize doing things that make you feel good. You feel no desire to change yourself because you know you're already flawless. You deserve that life, and you can have it. As we close, I want you to try and let yourself be completely in your body for a few breaths. And just listen to what your body is saying. Is it happy? Is it uncomfortable? And just keep breathing for a few seconds on your own time. And we'll do two big breaths together. Inhale. Exhale. Inhale. And exhale. And you can start to open your eyes and wiggle your fingers a little bit. So I want to start after that meditation. Thank you for doing that with me. I want to talk about my childhood and my native relationship to my body, the relationship to my body that I was born with. It was one of wonder, curiosity, pleasure, and intuition. Everyone around me had the same value. I liked people based on their weird personalities, right? I remember being in preschool. My boyfriend at that time was named Ray Ray. And Ray Ray was the smallest person in the class, and I was the biggest person in the class. And Ray Ray loved me for my body, you know? And it's and it's funny, right? Because I remember, and this was before I was taught that anything was weird about being big. I remember knowing that he was a lot smaller than me and just doing sort of rapid intuitive physics. I was like, okay, if we want to play a game that involves like one of us pushing or jumping on the other, he should be the person upon whom is jumped. Rather, I should be the person upon whom is jumped and he should be the jumper, because he was just smaller than me. Probably I was weaker at that time. So I love thinking about that time because honestly, I blocked it out of my memory for many years. And I'll tell you that story in a second. But I grew up in a household full of fat people. I was a fat baby. I look like my great-grandparents and my grandparents and all the family members I have pictures of going back. And it was a home where the word fat was never used. I was just considered interesting and special and beautiful. And my personality was always kind of a little bit rambunctious, and that was encouraged. And I used to love to jiggle. That was one of my favorite things. One of my favorite parts of the day was when I would get home with my grandmother running errands with her, and I would push open the front door, and I would run to the bathroom, and I would take off all my clothes, and I would run back out to the kitchen where she was always cooking, and I would spread out my arms and legs, and I would jiggle for her. And she thought it was so funny. I can remember her laughter, just such a joyful act of my like strange 4-year-old nudity. But the reason, I remember the chemical experience of pleasure. It was so powerful. And I loved that my body moved like water. It moved like the water in the bathtub or like at the pool. And I loved that my body could do this powerful thing. And at around the age of 5, which is the average age that children in the U.S. learn about fatness and thinness, which are largely social constructs. Yes, there are bigger people and there are smaller people. But what the implications of fat and thin are, we learn those things. And so I was 5 years old, and I began to experience what I did not know was called fat phobia. Mostly the boys around me began to make fun of my body and tell me that I was unlovable and undesirable. And that education continued for years and years and years. And I did what a lot of people in my position do, which is I looked around and tried to find a solution. And the solution that was presented to me was to restrict. I could exercise a lot, and I could eat as little food as possible. And the idea was that I would become a thin person. Well, it turns out it doesn't work like that. I'll get into that in a minute. but I believed every time the diet didn't work that it was something that I had done wrong. And I believed that I had failed, and I just hadn't read the fine print, and I just wasn't strong enough, and I didn't have the willpower. I did not know that even these diet companies knew that their products don't work, that the business model relies upon them not working. I did not know that at the time. And I proceeded to go into what I now realize was disordered eating. And as a fat person, I did not see it as disordered eating, because the idea is if you're fat, you can't possibly have an eating disorder. So I would go to the doctor, let's say at 11 years old, which was the first time I attempted starvation, essentially starvation. I would exercise 2 to 3 hours a day, and then I would eat lettuce and toast only. And I went to the doctor after 3 months of doing this at 11 years old, and he said, whatever you're doing, keep it up. If you get any smaller, you might be able to date one of my sons. And I mean, right, like my grandmother who loves me and was my caretaker, you know, didn't think there was anything wrong with this message, nor did I. And it would proceed like this, right, for years and years, right? Just so you know, the appropriate response of a doctor when a child is rapidly losing weight for reasons that they're not explaining to you, the appropriate response is concern and inquiry. So, you know, I would then, not having had any of that behavior question, I would go on to progress and starve even more. Again, at 18 years old, I undertook starvation again for the second time. This time I was living abroad, and my fantasy was that if I left and came back transformed, I could alter my life, you know, forever, right? Like the fantasy of this cinematic teenage transformation that we've all seen. It turns out that the only thing I did not get a transformation, I did get scurvy, however, which, you know, is like, it's a totally avoidable illness that only requires vitamin C, but I did not know about this, and I literally was eating a spoonful a day of food. And then about a month into that, I started to lose equilibrium. And I would get dizzy, and I would be tired all the time, and then I would be nauseous. And I did not understand this behavior as connected to, I did not understand these physical outcomes, which I experience as negative, as associated with my restriction behavior, because I thought my restriction behavior was positive. This is the depths of eating disorder brain. Honestly, if you're on a diet, you're on some version of that. This idea that there's a healthy way to restrict food and then an extreme way, they're part of a spectrum. There's not like, they're not silos. It's not like bucket A over here and then, you know, all the way on the other side of the building is over some other thing. They're on it, they're a spectrum behavior, and it's important to recognize that. Anyway, so my childhood, though, like it, right? So in the midst of all of this restriction and exercising and hating my body, I truly hated my body. I would wake up every day and my first thought would be, I hate this body. And I would proceed to do everything in my power to try and change it day after day after day. And I, as I mentioned, I blocked out the memories of that earlier childhood experience. And it wasn't until I was introduced to fat activism in my late 20s that I began to really question the culture. And I'm going to kind of take you in a deep dive on that. So what is fat phobia? A lot of people, as I mentioned, think of the attitudes we have towards fat people as health-motivated, as health-promoting attitudes. In actuality, fat phobia is a form of bigotry that positions fat people as, it's so hard. I have no slides up here, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to take, wait, am I still connected? Okay, cool, I'm going to walk.
Oh, there we go. Okay. So fat phobia is a form of bigotry that positions fat hatred and negativity as normal, positions fat people as naturally inferior, and positions weight gain as a sign of moral failure and lack of self-control. I did not know that what I was experiencing was a form of bigotry. I was essentially told that I was getting the behavior that I deserved because I needed to become a better, healthier version of myself. It's important to understand that fat phobia manifests on three different levels, like other forms of oppression. First is the intrapersonal, which is the self, how we feel about ourselves, what we think of when we wake up in the morning, what we see when we look in the mirror. The interpersonal is how others interact with us based on our body size. If you're a higher weight person, you might be experiencing things like romantic discrimination, even friendship discrimination. You might be experiencing workplace discrimination. You might be experiencing like any number of things, right? Like people talking about your body on the street, like complete strangers giving you feedback. I mean, I've had this experience. The other day I was having coffee and this woman was like, you just need to stop eating pork. I'm like, I'm drinking my latte right now. This is not welcome. And you know, I think that she really thought she was going to walk away thinking, I've done my good duty for the day. I'm like, nope, you have violated my civil and human rights. That's what you did. And then the third component was, which is the institutional component. This is the stuff that's society, right? It's bigger than individuals. It's bigger than two people interacting. It's things like, you know, can I fit into a chair? Can I get through, like, can I sit, can I get into a bathroom on an airplane? Are the chairs in the meeting weight tested for my body? And it includes things like, you know, to go back to the workplace, I mentioned this story in the last session. My former partner, who's an attorney, and he works at a very large firm, He was invited to do a team building activity, and he came home after that and was really upset and cried. And he said, you know, essentially they chose a weight restricted activity, indoor skydiving, and he felt really, really terrible. Like he was not part of the team, like he couldn't say anything, and like if he did, he would be ruining everyone else's good time. So a lot of activities and furniture, et cetera, are weight restricted. And we might not know this, but these are the kind of structural elements, the institutional elements that make up fat phobia. Another thing that people often don't realize is, for instance, medication. The efficacy of medication isn't tested above 170 pounds for women. This means, right, like it kind of made a huge splash in the UK because they found out that the most popular form of the morning after pill didn't work after 167, or I think it decreased efficacy at 167 and then completely lost all efficacy at 172 pounds. And the reality is, and you're going to see in a second, right, 68% of US women are a size 14 or above. We're the majority in the United States. And so, right, the fact that, like, many of us don't know whether or not or how efficacious important medication is a really big problem, and it's a huge part of institutional fat phobia. Another component of institutional fat phobia is actually medical discrimination. So in general, as an industry, the medical industry tests as having the highest fat phobic, like fat negative, fat phobic bias of any industry. And what doctors are kind of told to do is essentially for 2/3 of patients, again, because 2/3 of people are testing into that plus size range, right? The first line of defense is always weight loss. Or what you came in for. If anybody here is like over a size 6 or something, you've probably gone into the doctor with anything and they've said, well, have you thought about losing weight? I remember I had an injury related to my back and it was, you know, I knew what had happened. The injury was very clear. And they literally my doctor refused to give me any tools. They were like, you just need to lose weight. And I'm like, well, I'm in pain now. And they said, well, we really can't help you unless you're willing to do this thing. Like, this is a really common experience for higher weight people and even people who are, like, slightly above what is considered, like, you know, this very low BMI. So this kind of makes up the texture of what fat phobia looks like in people's lives. And depending on your size, you might experience one, two, or all three of those. The higher weight you are, the likelier you are to have more interactions with the institutional component. So I want to share some facts with you that can be really staggering, I think, for people. I shared this in the last session. So 0.8% is the chance a woman classified as, quote, obese could achieve a, quote, normal weight, according to a 2015 paper in the American Journal of Public Health. So this really gives texture to the fact that when we are attempting weight restriction, what's actually happening is weight cycling. You're gaining and losing the same weight over and over and over again, which has impacts on the immune system and the heart. Another thing is 5, as I mentioned, the average age in the U.S. that children learn fat phobia. $9,000 is actually the lowest estimate on how much income fat women lose per year, according to a 2014 Guardian article. The highest estimate is 19,000. And then 68%, the percentage of US women who are plus size, so 14 or above in the United States. The lose hate, not weight, like in order to adopt it, we must accept that diets are not data driven and that all bodies are valuable. And that it doesn't matter why someone is the size they are, you treat them like a person no matter what. You treat them with the full dignity and humanity that any person deserves. Dieting is an inefficacious behavior that primarily serves a social purpose of affirming norms, including a sexist preoccupation with regulating women's behavior and bodies. So one of the things when I'm talking to women, when they tell me, I want to lose weight, they usually mean, I want love, I want respect, I want to raise, I want to find clothes I like, right? None of those things are attached to weight loss. Those things are attached to access to full humanity, which we all get to have, we all get to fight for. I will say one of the things, I started writing for Forbes Women and interviewing CEOs and people who are in the plus size space and who are in the fashion space generally. And I was asking them, you know, what's going on? Like, why is the market serving the minority of US women? And a lot of the answer was, we don't know. We don't know. Essentially, it's a combination of entrenched bigotry, the refusal to accept that fat women want clothes at the size that they're at, right? Because the idea always was that plus-size women will not buy clothes because they do not want to stay at the size they currently are. So we will just make clothes for their aspirational selves. So the fashion industry is based on serving imaginary people, right? There is no, if you're like, there is no secret smaller person inside of you. There isn't. And I think what's really wild is like, right, it can be really painful to accept that, but it also is very freeing on the other end of that. Right. And I think to stay on this slide, one of the things I really wanted to drive home was that a lot of people are really focused on the data that says that thin people just live longer, better lives. And that kind of is the one that they drill home. It's like, but at the end of the day, but that. Well, the problem with that data point is that it doesn't take into account a lot of other data points that I would argue are far more compelling. The one I just shared with you, the 0.8%, right? The fact that we cannot turn a larger-bodied person into a smaller person with anything more than 0.8%, you know, like quote-unquote success rate, right? So that's important. The other thing that that data point doesn't take into account is the fact that larger, higher-weight people experience discrimination. Discrimination creates something called minority stress. Minority stress is something that they've noted in a lot of different groups, like people of color and queer people. It's a sense that you do not, essentially, you're not welcome in your society. And right, when you don't feel welcome in your society, it has incredible effects on your spirit, and that has effects on your psychology, and that has effects on your body. So what happens when you're in a stress response is that you have a release of adrenaline. Your body starts to, you know, your heart starts to work really hard. You're likelier to get high blood pressure. Minority stress is also linked to the suppression of the immune system, which leads to lower birth weights, which leads to likelihood of developing chronic illness. And then you add to the fact that when you're a higher weight person, you're experiencing romantic discrimination, medical discrimination, friendships might be difficult because people have this entrenched bigotry. You're now cutting off a person from all of these meaningful ways in which they can connect to other humans. And as I kind of mentioned, the meditation, we're all connected to each other. It is extraordinarily bad for humans to feel like other humans don't want to be around them because of something about who they are. So as I mentioned, we know that dieting, weight cycling, whatever you want to call it, these are inefficacious behaviors according to the data. Actually. Dieting is very good, however, there is correlation in the data with the following through it. An increased likelihood of an eating disorder, like an actual full-blown clinical eating disorder. Anxiety, depression, delaying of important life moments. So when I'm thin, I'll go on the vacation. When I'm thin, I will wear that skirt. When I'm thin, I will wear red lipstick. When I'm thin, I will dance. I will go to the beach. I will go to the ocean. I'll wear a bathing suit. These are really, really important life moments. And the idea that you don't get you don't deserve them until you're a different size is deeply painful and deeply bad for your mental health. Isolation, hunger, binging and hiding food. So what we found is that restriction leads to weird food behavior. So when you tell someone they can't eat what they want when they want, they start doing weird stuff. It's not that surprising. I mean, one of the things that blew my mind, I was working with one client and she, you know, she had never dieted her whole life, then decided she wanted to go to medical school. And she, in medical school, she was essentially, it was driven home. You got to be thinner, you got to be thinner, you got to be thinner, you got to be thinner. So she started restricting. And for the first time in her life, she started doing strange things. She described to me at one point that, you know, she would get up in the middle of the night and she'd be hungry and she'd make a whole cake and then she'd eat some of the cake and then she'd feel terrible and she'd throw the cake in the trash and then she'd eat the cake out of the trash. Right? And she couldn't, in her mind, she was like, wait, why am I doing this? This is so weird. Is this medical school related? Am I just stressed out? No, it turns out that restriction leads to weird food behavior. When you feel stigma or shame around what you're doing, it's going to pop up in other weird ways. So in fact, restriction is what leads to binging, not surprisingly. I mean, as someone who's researched this a lot. For me, in terms of the work and just the life component, the two things that I really want to focus on are gaslighting. So gaslighting is when someone questions your experience of reality. A really important way in which women are gaslit constantly is by asking, right, like, are you sure you want to eat that? Are you sure you need that much? All of us have heard this, I think. I mean, probably most of us have heard this, right? There's a way in which our fundamental human experience of hunger and satiation are taken away from us by diet culture. This is an extremely disorienting state to be in. Naomi Wolf, who wrote The Beauty Myth, wrote that dieting is one of the most potent political sedatives in history. Right? When you have a gaslit population, they are a pliable and controllable population, period. And in terms of the workplace, it takes up precious creative and professional bandwidth. I want to share some stories with you because it's so powerful. I started working with two women a few years ago. One of them is the executive director of this. She's like a lawyer and the ED of a justice center. And she was having a really, really hard time figuring out what she wanted to do. She was like, I know I'm unhappy, but I don't know what I want, and I don't know how to get there. I don't know how to access these things. I just feel confused and unhappy. And I was like, all right, first thing, you came to me, so the first thing I'm going to do is we're going to stop dieting. Like, you got to stop restricting. And through that process, she was able to travel that for her, dieting was not only about this feeling like she needed to conform as a woman to be attractive, to be desirable. She also had a lot of internalized racism. Like, she essentially realized that she thought of white women's bodies as ideal. And so she thought she could sort of diet her way into looking more, adhering more to the white feminine ideal. So she'd be taken more seriously at work and more seriously in life. Those things make sense, right? Because they're actually connected. Like, all oppressions, I think of it as a multi-headed hydra. It's like we think that everything's in its own little bucket. Again, it's not. It's not. There's all these different whack-a-mole, right? You got to get under the hood, as so to speak, and realize that these things are connected. So she stops dieting. She realizes that she's these connections to racism and sexism that she didn't even know were there, that were implicit in her dieting behavior. And what happens? She starts to have clarity. Because she's not spending every day worrying about every single bite of food that she's eating. It is extraordinary how much bandwidth can open up when you're not worried about whether or not this cookie is going to be the end of the world for you. And I want to talk about another person, an artist. She's a sculptor. She was having a lot of blockage, right? She came to me because she was like, I just can't get to the next level in my career. I love what I do, but I go into the workshop and I can't do anything in my studio. So again, I'm like, all right, well, you're with me, so we're gonna start with no dieting. Gotta stop dieting. And what happens a few months after that, she's creating some of the best work that she's ever created. And she comes to me and she says, it is because I stopped worrying about how much I weigh and what I'm eating that I was able to open up a path, right? Because she told me, she was like, the dieting was about denying my access to pleasure, my right to humanity, and my ability to be worthwhile no matter what size I am. These are extraordinarily important things to a creative. All right. So how do we change this? We're about to get into like the boot camp component. I have 9 steps that are kind of just like the very beginning. This is like the stimulus thing, the very start of the journey for the babe camper. So the first phase is that you've got to clear your path to babehood. Any of you, like you've probably heard, even Marie Kondo would share that you need to clear space if you want to have space for new stuff. So that's what this phase one is about. So the first thing is smash your scale. I'm somebody who's a recovering multi-day weigher. I used to hop on a scale multiple times a day as often as I could, right? And 68 million Americans are on a diet every year. So there's a good chance that some of you in this room have done this or are doing this now. What this does, right, is that it keeps you in that cycle of obsessing about every single bite of food, about what implications it's having, about what it could do to you, what it's going to do to your future, all the stuff, right? So if you remove these numerical preoccupations, if you get rid of the scale, that's like one of the easiest things to do. The numerical preoccupations kind of keep you in that cycle. And if you kind of interrupt it, you create a little bit of space to try something different. The second thing, no more negative body and food talk. This is actually great. This is like, I'm giving you permission to do less labor. Right? You do not have to talk about every bite of food. You don't have to monitor and talk about other people's consumption. You don't have to worry about whether or not somebody went on a walk or they didn't on their lunch break. And you also don't get to talk about yourself badly anymore and negatively anymore. One of the most transformative things that I ever did as a young feminist was we undertook an exercise in which we were not allowed to tell women anything, other women anything, except you look really beautiful today. And it was incredible, right? All my vocabulary I had to get rid of anything else. That was the only interaction I had with other women, was like giving them praise, seeing them. And I had to do this for a week. And it completely changed how I interacted with the world. And it allowed me a moment of space to audit all the little micro exchanges that may or may not have been toxic. So I don't know. At this point, I don't even really comment on women's appearance. I might talk about their outfit or something like that if it's praise. But I'm trying to sort of move away from that even. The third thing is that you can unfollow body shaming media. It is really important, and your body is telling you when it likes stuff and when it doesn't. So if you have an account that you follow, or a magazine that you're subscribed to, or a show that you're addicted to, and at the end of every time you interact with it, you feel like poop garbage, it is a really important thing for you to cancel that. What's amazing is this is kind of simple if you think about it, but it's the first step into setting boundaries. You're listening to what you want and what you don't want. This is like the beginning of boundaries. And then on top of that, when you begin to sort of say, no, I don't want this, yes, I do want this, you are giving yourself permission to curate the people and things that are interacting with you. And in so doing, you assert that you deserve that. And that's a really big lesson for women, really, right? Because we're taught to just agree with everything and do everything we're told and be nice and never be angry and all these kinds of things. And in actuality, it is a recipe to kill yourself or go insane, right? Like, we cannot continue to stay on this sexist path that we're on right now. I feel like the planet is indicating to us that we can't stay on the path that we're on right now. So we can start here with unfollowing body shaming media. The second phase is build something new. Eat and move for the sake of joy is my like fourth recommendation. And this is really difficult. We are taught, right? So the difference between food and diet is that diet is food with an outcome attached. The difference between exercise and movement is that exercise is movement with an outcome attached. when we decouple these extraordinarily central experiences of being a person from an outcome, we free up space to heal, right? And like we free up space to create the world that we want. It's really, really important to understand that food and diet, like this concept like of diet and exercise, they're really, really tied to capitalist production and productivity, right? Like we cannot have a moment when we're not somehow contributing to the wheel, even in our most private moments. And this has a long history, and I'm excited to tell you about it. So when I was a sexuality scholar, I now kind of identify as like a fat study scholar. When I was a sexuality study scholar, we learned about these two dudes. One is named Sylvester Graham. He invented the graham cracker. And one is named John Kellogg. He co-invented Kellogg's Corn Flakes. And I learned about them because they were they were like really, really anti-sex. Their whole activism platform was like circumcised and masturbation and pleasurable sex forever. That was their platform, right? And then I start learning, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting and strange. Then I learned about the history of food, fat, weight. These dudes show up again. And I'm like, how did they show up? Like, I went from studying sex, and now I'm studying food. Are you starting? I mean, is anybody seeing the connection? Anyway, I didn't see it. I was like, I don't understand how Sylvester Graham and John Kellogg are in this literature as well. Well, it turns out that they believe that you could use food to control sexuality. They believe that delicious, well-spiced food led to sexual excitation. And that's why they invented these bland foods. The graham cracker was even more bland when it was invented than it is now. Right? And Sylvester Graham was known as the prophet of bran bread. And his followers were part of what was called the dietary reform movement. And their idea was that you could control morality overall through what kinds of foods you ate. Right? And so you see, actually, I'm going to go all the way. I know this is like a corporate-y conference, but I'm going to take it all the way to the 301, okay? I was like, interesting. Why are they motivated to control what people eat and their wieners and stuff? I don't understand. Like I think it was John Kellogg is on the record talking about circumcising girls with carbolic acid if they masturbated, right? And I'm like, why are these dudes so obsessed with all this stuff? It's just kind of weird. And I had to go back a little bit further in history to understand that a lot of it was tied to colonialism. A lot of it was tied to the idea that there were men like them, and then there were the governed who were inferior. There were people who got to exploit, and there were people who were exploited. And so thus begins the construction of these kind of people do this, and these kind of people do that. We're the kind of people who control sex. We are above people who have a natural relationship to sex. We control what we eat. We're not like those people who just eat whatever they want or what's available to them. And it turns out this legacy continues to this day. We are still monitoring how like the have-nots eat and have sex, right, and all this stuff. So that's kind of the 301. I'm glad you went there with me. So I think it's important, let me go back and say, I think it's important to recognize that when we return to our native relationship to food and movement, we are interrupting a long history of things. All right. Number five, treat your body like the amazing thing that it really is. And we practice this a little bit in the meditation, but a lot of people look at their body and they see only what it cannot do, what it cannot get them. Well, we've been taught it cannot get them, right? We never look at the unsung things that our body does every single day. Like our lungs operate without conscious thought. Our heart beats without conscious thought. Like whenever we have an injury, our blood immediately starts to clot, right, for most of us. Our bodies start to mend whenever we have an injury. Our eyes can see a million colors, so many colors that language can't even can't even describe it. You have tiny hairs in your ear that allow you to perceive my voice, that allow you to tell the difference between like your partner and your kid or your boss or that person across the street. We do not see our bodies as these incredible things that need to be protected and honored. We see them as machines that are meant to get us outcomes. And this is right. This is the point where capitalism enters the understanding of something very private, our private bodies. And I want to say one thing that when I work with women, a lot of times when I ask them ultimately, why are you dieting? Why do you have an eating disorder? What are you getting out of this? A lot of them, you know, have a lot of reasons, right? But for a lot of people, it is romance. And in this particular instance, right, like when I'm talking, most of the women I work with, I guess I would say are straight identified. Like they identify as straight women, they date men. Right? And like they've kind of been told that unless they have a particular kind of body, they're not marriageable. They're not somebody who's going to be able to get dates and things like that. It's just expected, right? And what I realized as I got deeper again into the history of this issue was, and I argue, right, my theory is that it is not thinness that is being eroticized. It is the submission that thinness represents. Because you will notice throughout time and in different parts of the world, the beauty standard, the body standard changes, but it's always about controlling what women are doing. It's always about that. I want to offer a counterexample to our own culture that really surprised me when I was doing the research in grad school around this. I had to do a literature review before I did research. So I had to read everything that I could find about weight and gender and all these different kinds of things. And I found out that there were populations in different parts of the world where fatness was considered the height of feminine beauty and marriageability. And in these cultures, in a couple of them, they actually had fattening rituals. So there were particular fattening consultants who would be hired within the community to make the daughters of the people who had access to consultants, right, to make them as fat as possible in anticipation of getting them married off well. And in this process, what happens is women are taken, the girls, often they're young, are taken away from their family and kept together in isolation in a hut during which they're fed very, 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 very large amounts of very, very rich foods. And they get punished if they throw up. In hopes of literally, I mean, in one of the cultures, the height of feminine beauty, the thing that will take you from like babe to mega babe is stretch marks on the arm. So that particular like imagery is very, very attractive in this particular culture. And so the consultant would get a bonus. They could create that outcome, or they believe they could create that outcome, right? Anyway, right? And so at the end of the day, they're radically different beauty ideal than the one we know, where women do almost anything to be thin. It's a radically different body ideal, but at the end of the day, it's women who are paying for it. It's women who are suffering. And it's ultimately about this idea that women deserve to be controlled and other people get to determine what we do with our bodies and our lives. These are extraordinarily private things, right? Like our body is the most private thing that we have. Next, lean way into the people, places, and things that make you feel good. It's different for different people. I live in San Francisco. I live right next to Golden Gate Park, and so that's a place that makes me feel really good. I have a partner who is extraordinarily fat positive and very, very, very supportive. Like this morning I woke up and there was a text from him that was like, "You're amazing." you know, and like so right, like find the community, find the people, find the things that make you feel good. Because what's amazing, right, like is when you have a counterpoint, like when you're experiencing trash and you have a counterpoint to reference, I'm like, you know, there was a time when I didn't feel like this. I remember it. I have a person who doesn't make me feel this way. When you can call that into reference, it helps highlight what isn't working. Not only does leaning into the stuff that's amazing regenerate you and nourish you, it also helps you see bright as day what isn't working, what isn't making you feel good. So I kind of want to take a second for us to brainstorm one person, one place, one thing that makes us feel good. I'm going to give you like 30 seconds. All right. The final phase is change the world. No big deal. Number 7, create access when you can. And this includes for you and for others. This ultimately benefits everybody. It turns out that when we create access for the most marginalized people, every single person benefits from that. That's what's so incredible about it. But I have the image of chairs here because, right, like one of the most incredible access things that you can do is have chairs that don't have armrests. Have chairs that are weight tested in your workspace or whatever. Another thing to do is to check and see, right? Like, are there weight restrictions on behaviors or activities that I want to do at work or with my friends? If we're going to go out and eat, or is there seating that, again, has armless chairs? And is there seating that isn't booth seating? Another really fantastic thing, if you're in a hiring position, a position to hire people, close the wage gap, right? Close this like this fat, thin wage gap that I mentioned earlier, $19,000. And also recognize, this is a big part of access, I was mentioning this earlier, but is access to clothing. I got an email a few days ago from a student who just graduated from law school. And she said, I cannot find a single thing in size 16 to show up in these interviews to. How are they going to take me seriously? I'm trying to apply to like huge law firms. And I'm trying to wear a polyester suit to that. And I feel like trash. It's important to remember, again, if you're like in a hiring position, maybe this person got the best thing that they had access to. And maybe they don't look as sharp as another candidate who's a smaller bodied person because they literally cannot buy that thing. It does not come in their size. And that's an important thing to consider. Number 8 is self-advocate at the doctor. Again, even if you're not a higher weight person, these things affect everybody and benefit every single person. Insisting to your doctor, I would like weight neutral treatment. What would you tell a thin patient if you're a higher weight person? And then also, right, there's incredible resources like the book Health at Every Size, which advocates for weight-neutral approaches to health promotion. And what happens, right, like when we decouple health outcomes from weight, when we stop seeing weight as the primary indicator of wellness, we actually free up the possibility of all kinds of amazing things happening in the wellness space, right? Like, it turns out that every single person benefits from walking outside for 20 minutes or laying in the forest for 20 minutes or eating something like that comes from the ground. Every person benefits from those things. And if our desire is not to ultimately do whatever we can to just make sure that person is lower weight, we actually free up space to be like, okay, what are the indicators? Like, can we improve this person's heart health? Can we improve their mental health? How can we make their life better? Because those things ultimately create physical health. And then finally, radically reframe. Every person deserves to live free from bigotry and discrimination, regardless of size or health status. This is a radical reimagining of how we currently exist, right? This seems really self-evident, but it's quite radical. So I wanted to tell you about a couple of things that are coming up for me as we're closing up. My new book, The Self-Love Revolution, Radical Body Positivity for Girls of Color, comes out in May. You Have the Right to Remain Fat is my manifesto, essentially, and I'm going to be at the signing after this. And then in February, I'm working with a New York-based company on launching a podcast called Rebel Eaters Club. Where we talk about our cultural relationship to food, right? You may have noticed that our culture is very anxious about food, like good food, bad food, evil food, all that stuff. We talk about it on the show, and I talk to people like artists and like restaurant critics and things like that about the history of how we got here and how we can change things. And then was share with you one quote from the introduction to the Self-Love Revolution. And that is, your body is political because when you listen to it, you have the power to radically transform the culture, the planet, and history. So I'm going to leave you there. Thank you so much for joining me.